Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
Well, Bill, what do you have for us?
Well, Aaron, you know what? We have a sponsor this hour, Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. And Pape handles everything, tractors, implements, mowers, you name it. Go up and see them. They've got a pretty good inventory right now. They also do full parts and service. So if you've got an older machine you need to get fixed up, give them a call. Their phone number is 226-9226. And they're at, did I say they were at 3119?
Twinview Boulevard?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay, I just did again. Yeah. Or you can get them on the web at
3119 Twinview Boulevard?
No.
Oh, no, not that.
No, not that. We already did that three times. Their website is papemachinery.com.
I couldn't resist.
Yeah, we'll have to redo that whole thing top of the hour.
Yeah, next week. We're going to redo it next week on Sunday, probably right around noon.
Yeah.
12:05.
Okay.
Hey, and so, you know, you might want to get, you guys have steel products, which some of those are gas-powered. You might want to tell people about.
Yeah, I guess California is going to ban all the gas-powered stuff. So, you know, if you want a gas-powered...
Like weed whackers and...
Weed whackers, trimmers, chainsaws, riding mowers, all that stuff is going to be unable to retail in California. I think it's 2023 is when they're trying to do away with all that. I know in San Francisco and I think
Unless
Napa,
we can do away with all that.
Yeah. San Francisco and Napa have already... past ordinances where you can't, everything has to be electric. It's clean.
Because electric just comes from,
It just comes out of the wall.
Yep.
Yeah,
That's it.
Yeah, there's no fossil fuels used in the production of this electricity.
Yeah. Oh, Lord. Where do we find these people and how do we get rid of them?
I don't know.
For the people who are in California, I know we have a lot of people who are not in California, but if you are, you're, big chance here is September 14th. Make sure you, if you are in a fire zone, for instance, and your mail is all over the place, just go to your county clerk, have your ballot canceled and reissued. They can do that for you. So there is, for all the people panicking that, the folks that got relocated or burned out won't be able to vote, they absolutely will be able to vote. On the recall of Gavin Newsom, not to put too fine a point on it, but that is what it is for. It's
and
the
you
recall
might want
of Gavin
take
Newsom.
Take your ballot right to the ballot drop-off area because I guess felons have been found with carloads of ballots.
No.
Oh, yeah, only in California.
And there's a whole big thing about the envelopes that have the ballot envelopes have like a hole punch that goes through the whole envelope so that they can tell by just looking at it if it has a ballot in there or not to make sure none of them get left. It's not anything nefarious. It's just
you can't tell how you voted by looking through the hole.
Right. So apparently two of the 58 counties, maybe three, in California, if you put the ballot in one direction and you voted yes on the recall, you can see the yes check mark through the hole, but the vast majority of the counties do not have that.
Ours was not like that.
I tried.
I did. I folded mine four times couldn't get it lined up with the hole.
Yeah, Bill's over there doing origami. No.
Nope, that won't work. Unfold.
They'll never know how I voted.
I did a nice swan, though.
I do want you to know I dropped it off, by the way. Got that all handled. So anyway, just make sure you do that, and it's the end of August. What is today? August 29th. 2021, in case we re-air this show. So if you hear this at some other time and you're going, what recall? Sorry. It has come and it is gone.
That's what Gavin said.
Exactly. God, don't you hope. So I got a call from this lady last week. And all of a sudden she was talking about all this really interesting stuff. And I thought the same thing I always think. This is horrible. I'm the only person hearing all of this. I asked her, I said, so are you free on Sunday? Because maybe you could tell me all this while other people could hear about it, too, because it was really different. I told Bill, I go, hey, we're doing a show on concrete.
Oh, good.
And he's like,
I've been lousy. I can't trowel concrete worth a darn, and so I'm hoping maybe she can help me with some technique.
Yeah, we're going to do that over the radio.
Yeah.
Everyone just change the channel. Anyway, really interesting. And so, honestly, it's... I titled the show kind of what I wound up walking away with. You know, what do military veterans, infrastructure, specifically concrete, and national parks have in common? And the answer is
Tonya Wattenberg.
Tonya Wattenberg Comas. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then She said, my dad did radio. And I was like, wait a minute, Bill Wattenberg? Like the KGO guy? Well, as a matter of fact, that happened to be your dad. So just a lot of fun coincidences. And before we bring her on, I was reading a little bit about him. And it was very, very interesting. It's the little blurb I found on some, I guess it was the Daily Post here. It said, on his show, Wattenberg answered questions about everything from car repairs to physics and would often help kids who called in with homework questions. While kind to children, Dr. Bill had a gruff, a suffer-no-fools attitude with grown-ups. He advocated for nuclear energy, criticized the Sierra Club. I was pretty happy right there. And argued that failure to clear the high country underbrush would lead to massive wildfires.
It was imagine
that.
Yeah.
Tanya was calling me specifically about Greenville, California, the little town that basically in majority burned down, because she had some ideas on how to fix it. And I thought, what an interesting world we live in.
Yeah.
So, Tanya, thank you for taking time out from moving your son to or from college.
To college. And I apologize for that helicopter that just went over.
Oh, I missed it. I missed the helicopter, okay. But I was at a fire meeting yesterday and it was all full of helicopters. So I think we all hear helicopters in our in the back of our mind now.
Yeah.
Well, I don't even know where to begin other than my burning question. I guess I should give a little blurb of your bio because it's pretty striking. I started reading. I'm like, wow.
Okay.
Wow. I'm not going to make you do it because it kind of sounds like that.
You didn't know how exciting concrete could be, did you?
I had no idea. I'm like, you're kidding me. She's like, oh, I'm in concrete preservation. I was like, okay. I was sort of stumped at that point, but apparently you are one of the five most influential people in the concrete industry in 2013 as rated by Concrete Construction Magazine. You have a PhD in architecture from Texas A&M, Master of Science in Historic Preservation from Columbia in New York, bachelor's in landscape architecture from the University of California, Davis. I have an English degree from Humboldt State, so, you know, don't try to fool me.
I'm going to pull it over your eyes,
Bill
that's
went
for sure.
To Butte, so. But we're snarky. They didn't trade that out of us. So you are actually the founding director and CEO of CPI, which is the Concrete Preservation. I always get this wrong.
Institute.
Preservation Institute Foundation. I always want to call it the foundation, but Institute goes first. Which is super interesting. It's an official U.S. military career skills program for active duty military and partner of the U.S. National Park Service at Alcatraz Island and Pearl Harbor, restoring landmark structures and training service members for civilian careers. I thought, how great is that? Everybody says, how come nobody cares about our veterans? Well, you're married to an Army veteran, and obviously you do care about them a lot. You're also a professor emeritus at the California State University Chico, which is probably why you're down there. College of Engineering, so that's cool. Research and projects with NASA for CO2 reduction and durable cement development. I don't know what that is, but we'd like to know. And nationwide industry certification for concrete repair. I'm looking at all this. You've been in Normandy, the landing site at Normandy. You've had appearances on History, Discovery, American, and the American Heroes Channel, which used to be the Military Channel. I think we all still call it the Military Channel. And technical structure and infrastructure advisor for the studios. So I'm guessing we're talking movie studios?
For the
yoga
studio
channel.
History Channel.
Okay. Well, okay.
On
so
one particular show. I don't span their entire network.
Okay. Well, yeah, I don't think anybody can. They're on like 9,000 channels. Every time I turn it on, it's some other channel. They're starting to turn into like the news or the sports thing. Yeah, ESPN 1 through 99. Okay, so you're a little girl and you're growing up and you lived in Greenville or near Greenville.
And we had forest fires all the time, right?
Yeah.
You know, so let me give you the three things I think to give everyone a sense of where I'm going with some of what I want to talk about.
Absolutely.
First of all, passion and anger over the Dixie Fire. We kind of covered some of my qualifications, which we'll talk about, the nonprofit foundation that I developed and run. And then I think most importantly is there are some specific solutions. Not a lot of whining here. I want to just present some very specific solutions that we that could help not only the natural resources in the forest, but, you know, my work is more in the national parks with cultural resources, meaning the things that people built versus natural. So I want to talk about the Dixie Fire and the personal impact, me, my family, everybody else, you know, not just in Greenville, but, you know, Canyon Dam is gone and other towns are threatened, and next year it will be other towns, right?
Absolutely.
You know, as a child, we lived in these old wooden structures way up on the town on the mountain outside of town. And, you know, I always remember helicopters going over and my uncle or my brother hopping on a bulldozer. There were three lumber mills in Indian Valley at that time. When there were fires, the forests were well managed. You know, the people who owned those logging companies had a stake in healthy forests. There were people there. There were resources there. So whether it was a Forest Service working with the local community, fires then were a natural thing. The forests were cleared, and we all felt safe. It never crossed our mind that something like this could happen. But, you know, mid-'80s, when all the logging industry died, and I'm not an expert on all of that, but I do remember mention of a spotted owl multiple times. You know, when those forests became unmanaged, or maybe some people in Washington, D.C. feel like they are managing them, you know, I am certainly not an expert on climate change. You know, maybe the world is getting warmer, but we've had ice ages and melting of ice ages in the history of this planet, so I'm not going to go into why at all. I don't know on the climate change part of it, but maybe it is hotter. Maybe we are a little bit drier. But that does not excuse the mismanagement.
Exactly.
You know, I'll tell you what, you know, one of the guys that lives up near us took all of his things just a few weeks as the fire was raging down into town. It was like, we knew the risk of living up on the mountain in the trees, and we cleared, and like you mentioned, my father said, my brother and sister and I walked around up in the woods a week ago, and the fire did not burn our place. Miraculously.
Wow.
But the clearing had been done.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of property up on the mountain. We had done the clearing over the years, the selective logging. We had a cleanly managed forest. There was some backburning that was done because we were sort of the line between the fire and town there for a while. So there could be a lot of reasons why. But I will tell you that if and when people can go walk around and see that massive, heartbreaking devastation, not just for people, but all the wildlife. And you look at the forests that were well-logged, well-managed, and those that were not, there's no arguing. There's just no arguing. And one of the issues going on right now is that, you know, for instance, our property up there, we have a natural spring with clean water. We have a sewer system that has been operating ever since we've been there for 50 years. And there are other landowners around the valley. We're all fighting really hard to make sure that the recovery is locally based. You know, why can't we put people in Greenville? And I understand the residents that are displaced may need to, you know, there's a lot of factors that play into this. But there are resources and people and energy that still exist in Indian Valley. And we've got to make sure that recovery effort is based in Indian Valley. The leaders controlling this need to be there. Let's not put them over in some other big town where they can take a bow and get a promotion because they had a photo op, right?
Well, and let's also make sure that it doesn't become, you know, oh, this looks like it used to be a town once upon a time. Because we've all driven through those places too.
Yep, yeah. So what's going to happen as we go forward? It's just, you know,
I think it's interesting how many industry people are up there. As I'd mentioned to you the other day, you know, Randy Pugh, dealt with him in our past life when we were in the timber business, and he is a superior businessman and really, really smart in the logging industry. And he's up there in Greenville, and then all of a sudden there's someone with some historic preservation background. I'm like, How interesting. I mean, I've been to Greenville a million times. I had no idea who was living there, apparently. Let us take a really quick break, and then we're going to come back with our guest, Tanya Comas. And you're listening to We the People. You can find out everything about this show at wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
Of the right era, the wrong industry, but you know, that's kind of how all those little towns were. You know, the industry was the town, and Greenville was absolutely a logging town.
Absolutely. If you're okay with it, I would like to kind of segue from forests to some of what the Nonprofit Foundation does, and there is a very strong link between the two in terms of the solutions that we're trying to solve.
Oh, absolutely. We're just following along. We're passengers in the car today.
Okay, excellent. So I guess, you know, overall, if you look at something like, you know, the forests are suffering right now, and cultural resources like Battleship Row, for instance, you know, is mismanagement of that hallowed site also threatened. And I'll tell you some stories about our work over there and in the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, specifically Alcatraz Island in San Francisco, and some of the leadership issues. And I should be very clear, because we are partners of the National Park Service and also the Department of Defense, and I should say very clearly and repeatedly that there are a lot of really good, hardworking people in the Park Service and the Forest Service, and what I'm really referring to here is the leadership, you know, the people who have never actually had to sign the front of a paycheck in their entire career, and they are, you know, avoiding responsibility and taking PR opportunities without really any accountability, you know, long-term accountability. So that's something that we battle quite a bit. And I'm going to mention something right now, and we'll come back to it at the end, but just so that people can see where I'm going. Historic preservation, especially in small communities, maybe, you know, more rural communities, is often regarded as, oh, we don't want that because then the government's going to tell us what to do with our buildings. I do have a degree in preservation, and, you know, I love old buildings. But I will say that there's a lot that goes into that. If local ordinances are written correctly, they absolutely are not necessarily prescriptive. So that's a good thing. Where I want to go with this, though, one of the solutions that I think can help the forests, can help national parks, is to use existing laws. So let's not try to create a bunch of new laws that maybe conflict with old ones. There's a very specific, perhaps even to a lot of people, esoteric little part of the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966. There is a term in that act called the adverse effect. And within that, it basically says that any proposed action to a historic resource or action that was already implemented, if the sort of powers that be decide that it was adversely affected that structure, it can have legal implications. So again, that term adverse effect is already in federal law. Well, there's another term called demolition by neglect. And there's a lot of argument that demolition by neglect is an adverse effect. So let's look at that in a bigger sense. Is forest mismanagement demolition by neglect?
All day and twice
all day long?
And twice during the summer? Yeah.
Right. And, you know, a town like Greenville was not incorporated, does not have a historic preservation ordinance. Oddly enough, though, that law applies to buildings that are listed on the National Register of Historic Places or could be listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Greenville was a historic mining town. I could probably have gotten every building on Main Street nominated to the National Register. So there are laws out there right now, and the issue I have with it is something like demolition by neglect is usually something that the government at many whatever level uses against private developers or private owners. So, for instance, somebody owns an old building that is in a block that's all being, you know, upgraded and higher rents, and they're stuck with this old building. So to circumvent the National Historic Preservation Act, an owner or a developer may just decide to ignore the building long enough that it falls into such disrepair that it has technically been demolished. And then they can go in and make the case that I have to demolish it. So that's demolition by neglect. And that is typically levied against the private sector. What I'm suggesting, and I'm no lawyer, and I'm sure somebody could look this up, I'm suggesting we flip that on its head. And we start looking at elected official decisions that have led to demolition by neglect, and we charge them in the same way that they are charging the private industry. It's a clearly defined, in the historic preservation world, well-known concept. But it's always the thing levied against private. And I really feel like if we're going to have leadership making these kinds of decisions, they should be held accountable in the same way.
Yeah. If you were going to take, like, hanging off the list, you know, that would be the second thing people clamor for the most when all this stuff is going on. Hanging's probably bad. Probably can't do that. But holding them accountable, that's a novel idea.
Right. And, you know, holding them accountable is a big, broad term, right? How do you do that? Do they, I'll give you an example, and I have to always be a little careful because there are excellent people in the National Park Service. There are a few leaders that have not fulfilled their responsibilities, and unfortunately, our nonprofit foundation doesn't necessarily pay the price, but the military people who have signed up to do our program have. So I'll give you a little bit of background on the CPI Foundation. I used to teach at Chico State. Believe it or not, there are 4 universities in the country, now 5, that have an entire Bachelor of Science degree in concrete.
Isn't that wild?
it's a technical degree, typically in the College of Engineering or Construction, depending on the university, with a minor in business. So it was really something that the concrete industry got behind and helped fund and gave money to universities and said, you guys know how to develop curriculum. We need people who know concrete and how to manage it, how to manage the companies and the logistics and you know, everything that goes into it. So I taught and ran that program for 10 years and ended up kind of de facto becoming an expert in concrete repair. There was an interesting thing that happened in the last recession, the 2008 era, where not a lot of money was being put into new infrastructure, you know, by Caltrans or other federal, you know, federal highways or whatever. And so a lot of repair started to happen. when there wasn't money to build new, you fix the old stuff.
Yeah, true.
But there was a real lack in the industry of any kind of, number one, enough people that knew how to repair concrete, because it's very different than putting down new concrete. And there were no industry standards. So that led to the certification for concrete repair that I helped work on with some other very, very smart people. So the three legs of the CPI Foundation are military service members seeking training for when they get out so they can get a job. There's infrastructure, and then there's the parks. So let me start with the military service member part of it. We trained military veterans for several years at Alcatraz, and then in 2016, the Department of Defense approached us to start training active duty servicemen members in their final six months of service. They could apply to do our program. And so we were one of the first approved programs by DOD to do this kind of training. So they report to us 12 weeks full-time. They are still active duty service members, and they are still paid by the United States Department of Defense while they're doing this training. So think of it as an internship, preparing them for their next career. Why it makes sense to the American taxpayers is while we're training them, they're helping complete major structural repair work in the parks that needs to get done anyway. And we have a lot of industry partners across the country that help support the program because they believe in what we're doing, and they're hoping to hire these young men and women when they come out of service. So when I say active duty, most people are thinking veteran, but we're actually training them prior to getting out.
Which is great.
In our experience, what we have found after having trained veterans for a certain length of time and then moved on now into active duty is the cliff that a veteran can fall off in terms of, wait, I'm out of service, I'm not wearing a uniform, I don't have a paycheck, and now I'm in an unemployment line. And the spiral downwards, if we can catch them while they are still standing tall, standing proud, ready for their next adventure, get them a job offer before they take off the uniform, the success rate is much higher.
I mean, that there is nothing that would make that a bad idea. Except, you know, not a bad idea, but I guess for you guys, how do you do it logistically?
It's a lot of work, and it takes a lot of work.
I was just thinking about that. I'm like, wait a minute, they're not here. They're not in Alcatraz when they get out. I mean,
no, they're not. But, you know, when you really look at, we work with all military branches, all five, if you count the Coast Guard on top of that. We have just some really good people working with us, and, you know, if they're stationed in Germany or Japan or Hawaii or Alaska, we'll help arrange, you know, if they can get to an Air Force base, they can take a space available Air Force flight to Travis Air Base, and we go pick them up. You know, it's kind of, there's a lot of logistics that go into it. They live in the national parks, There's some old military barracks there. So we are responsible for them 24/7 and responsible to deliver them back to their military base when it's all over. But it's a win-win-win, you know, that the service members getting the training and our goals, that they have a job offer before they finish the program. We work on their resume and interview skills and, you know, okay, where is it you want to live? And is that more important than making a whole bunch of money if you lived over there? Let's work that out.
It's the wraparound services that that everyone thinks we should have, but that no one provides. You guys are doing something that we should be doing as a country, but no one figured that
right.
out.
Right, And we're doing it from a private industry perspective.
Exactly.
You know, we are very accountable to the construction and material supply companies who support us and want to hire these people. So, you know, we are a nonprofit, but we function very much like a for-profit organization with very accountable to our stakeholders. You know, and when you talk about sort of moving on in the infrastructure part of things, the country's talking about this huge infrastructure bill right now. Well, okay, great. Let's throw a bunch of money at it. Who's going to build it?
Mm-hmm. That's what always happens with these infrastructure things. It sounds great, and then all this money goes out, and everybody looks around and goes, did anything happen by you? No. You? No.
I mean, right. Because it's going to go through levels and levels and levels of government and oversight and planning, and this construction company has to hire that one, and then we have to have this other company involved. And, you know, so every company out there, I don't care if it's construction or the, you know, hospitality industry and whatever, everybody's looking for employees right now. So an infrastructure bill would be great, but we've got to have people to do the work.
Absolutely.
There are anywhere, on average, 250,000 people complete their military service and become civilians every year in this country.
250,000?
A quarter of a million
U.S.
citizens become civilians leaving the military every single year. And we're not doing nearly enough for them.
No. And the vocational rehab, I mean, So anyone who's had to deal with that, you know, just apologize, you know, because there's just nothing good to say about it. Every now and then, people luck out, but more times than not, they're funneled into fields that are, okay, classic example. Guy was a medic, really wanted to get a nursing degree. They said, you probably shouldn't. They forced him to get a barber's license.
Oh, my.
From a school of barberness, whatever that is. I don't know. What are they? Cosmetology, I guess, which just makes me...
barberness, I like that.
Shut up, Bill. Bill's looking at me. Barberness. You know, barberness. And the place was under investigation, closed down. The guy wound up, you know, from pillar to post, living in a travel trailer in another town, just trying to finish it. But he had all this training as a medic. And so, and that's just one of a bazillion stories. Your program, it's about 8,000% better.
Yeah, and, you know, when we hear of low unemployment rates and how veteran unemployment rates are so low, I don't have the statistics. I've had other people have looked at this, and there's another statistic that is probably more important for a veteran. It's not the initial job they get right out of the service. It's where are they 1 year later? Because so many of them will take the very first job offer they get, even if it's not where they want to live, it's not making enough money to support their family, and it's not, like you were just mentioning, not in their expertise area.
It's kind of like, you know, we have a slot. Here, we'll put you in that one. No thought given.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you want to do? What are you good at doing? What would, what would make your life feel... These are people who've brought value to the country. They should be able to walk away. If they're going to have help on that, they should be able to walk away with something that makes them feel good as well. It's just ridiculous.
Right. And another way to look at that is, you know, I'm sorry, were you?
I was going to say, Travis is in there waving his arms. We shut off all the lights in here because it just felt like we were getting interrogated. So we're all working in the dark. But I could see his arms moving, so he's either landing a plane or it's time for a break. I'm guessing break, since I don't hear any engines. Yeah, give it time. After that barberness, we're probably on the drone list. Barbers don't have drones, so what a break. So let's see. We're chatting here with Tanya. Tanya, how do you actually pronounce your name so I don't do it incorrectly?
It is Tanya Comus.
Comus, okay, just like it looks, but I thought, people's names are tricky. And I really hope that if people have friends, family, relatives, neighbors, whatever, that are military service members, I really hope that you will pass this information along to them, and we'll get a little more specific on how exactly they do that. But I can tell you now, the website is awesome. We have that all linked up. But her site is cpi-foundation.org, and we have all those links on our site. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.
You can bet that I stand ready. When the wolf growls at the door, hey, I'm solid, hey, I'm steady, hey, I'm true down to the core, and I will always do my duty, no matter what the price. I've counted up the cost, I know the sacrifice. Oh, and I don't want to die for you, but if dying's asking me, I'll bear that cross with honor. Cause freedom don't
come free. I'm an American soldier, an American. Beside my brothers and my sisters, I will proudly take a stand. When liberty's in jeopardy, I will always do what's right. I'm out here on the front lines, sleep in peace tonight. American soldier, I'm an American soldier.
When there we were all in one place, a generation lost in space, with no time left to start again. So come on, Jack, be nimble, Jack, be quick. Jack Flash sat on a candlestick, 'cause fire is the devil's only friend. Oh, and as I watched him on the stage, my hands were clenched in fists of rage. No angel born in hell could break that Satan spell. And as the flames climb high.
There you go. Flames climb high.
I know.
Yeah.
All the songs with fire, so many of them. Songs we used to like when we were in high school. It was funny. I was at a fire meeting up in Old Station where they're watching the fire come over the hill, wondering if they're going to be burned out next. And sitting by a couple people that hadn't started yet. And the folks in front of me, the lady said, we were talking about people camping in the National Forest and that they had closed the forest. And she said, I don't even think it'd be fun to camp. She goes, and I said, well, you know, they wouldn't let them have campfires or anything. She goes, I would never have a campfire again. She goes, the smell just reminds me of summer. I hate it.
That's pretty sad.
Yeah, you know, you live in rural America when the smell of a campfire reminds you of summer. Ugh. All right, Tanya, now where?
All right. Well, we were talking a little bit about infrastructure.
Yes.
And the need for, you know, if we're going to have an infrastructure bill, that we're going to need workers to do it. That's, you know, it's one goal of our small foundation is, right, train some people who will want to go into those types of jobs. There's also some interesting background. And again, I'm linking this right back, at least in my mind, that, you know, it's management of forests or management of infrastructure or management of historic buildings and who is responsible and what's really getting done. I promise when I go off on this little tangent, it will link back to infrastructure.
Okay, we love tangents.
I'm already playing it in my head.
Okay. Pointe du Hoc, Normandy, France. It was the D-Day landing site between Utah and Omaha beaches. I took some students over from Chico State in 2008 and 2009 as part of a project headed by Texas A&M University. And the issue there is the German command post at Pointe du Hoc was critical to the success of D-Day. The cliff had been eroding and the structures, the concrete, the German concrete structures at the top, were being threatened. And so I was the sort of the concrete repair person, and there were a lot of other geophysics and technical engineers from Texas A&M. That is actually what led to the program at Alcatraz and on to Pearl Harbor and the active duty training program. But I became very fascinated with Eisenhower as one of my all-time heroes, both General Eisenhower and President Eisenhower. His brilliance in logistically winning World War II is something he brought back to the United States. And as of him becoming President Eisenhower, we didn't have a U.S. interstate system in this country, partly for defensive reasons. It was important to him that you could get equipment, people from one coast to the other in the case of a war, because he experienced in Europe you couldn't get from point A to point B with tanks. So a lot of our interstate system, the system of the roads, the numbers of the roads, the way that they're organized was national defense, along with commerce, because, you know, the world was coming back out from under the cloud of World War II at the time. So if you look at that, all of our infrastructure is that old. And that's the reason everybody's all up in arms about it now. But back to the idea of concrete or national forests being something that, that you can just sort of manage from afar and hope it doesn't happen on your watch. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Concrete doesn't fall apart, right? Forests will be fine, or we just don't let them burn, or we let them burn, or we do whatever. So that, do you have any questions there? It sounded like somebody had a question.
No. No, we were just...
Oh.
Those were random government noises that there were the little helicopters that live inside the wires.
Got it. I listened to one of your guests from about a year ago, and I will mispronounce his last name, but Ray Haupt.
Yeah, Ray Haupt. Yeah.
Okay. And I wrote down a quote that he said. He said, "The knee jerk is always 20 years behind."
Yep.
Yeah, that's,
and I
that's
thought
right.
that was perfect.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, people have seen this for, I mean, gosh, you know, the Forest Service, the retired, he's part of the, I think he said that in that show several times, he's part of the retired Forest Service employees, the retirees group, he always refers to it as, and still a registered professional forester. All those folks have said for such a long time, they said, you know, we're either going to change this policy, make a radical change in the policy, or we will have no forest in 40 years. And I guess at this point, I'm thinking 40 years is kind of optimistic.
Yeah, that's very optimistic when you're burning down a million acres in one fire.
Right. And we have politicians and federal department leaders who are betting that it won't happen on their watch.
Yeah, because that's a great criteria, right? Not that it won't happen. It just won't happen while they're holding the reins of the buggy. Well, and the guy who's responsible for Region 5... The Forest Service Region 5, which is, you know, consistently in flames, and they've spent a lot of time managing fires. Like I think of Happy Camp all the time. They had a fire up on the hill, and they watched it for, I think it was 4 days, could have been longer, but people in town were like, hey, there's a fire, we're like right there, it's right there, right above the town, you can see it, it's right on the hillside, visible for everybody. And they said, yeah, we're keeping an eye on it. And they said, well, you know, the wind comes up, and, you know, we really probably shouldn't let that just sit there. And sure enough, wind came up, became a massive fire. I forgot the name of it. It was a few years ago. But they literally watched it until it exploded. And we've all heard those stories. Anyone who lives out here has heard those stories. And that guy's now the chief of the Forest Service, the guy promoting that policy. He's the chief of the Forest Service. They put out an edict that said they needed to... I really should have gotten it before we came on, but here's my paraphrase, that they were going to stop doing fire management, they were going to do fire suppression as long as it was safe. It had a bunch of caveats that basically said, so we're going to keep doing the same thing we were doing.
Wow.
So much for that.
Right. Well, and I'll link that right back to where I do have a little more expertise, which is in, you know, in the national parks with the, you know, all the cultural resources. You know, we've had a very successful program in the Golden Gate Natural Recreation Area, like I said, at Alcatraz for many years. We expanded to Pearl Harbor. If you've never been to Alcatraz, I encourage you to go.
I've been like 15 times, so I've seen your work.
Oh, there's some things that you haven't seen.
I've seen where your work needed to be. How's that?
Right, right. Well, it's a 22-acre island of all concrete structures.
And yeah.
There's every type of deterioration there, every construction system there. Some interesting things like, you know, what do you do when... So the military built all of that. Not everybody knows that, but... The cell house on Alcatraz was the largest reinforced concrete building in the world when it was built.
Wow.
By the United States military. So it had been different uses over the years by the military, but by the time it became military prison, it was mostly built by prison labor. So there's some very curious, you know, if you think that prisoners probably aren't highly motivated to build a strong building, right?
You would think they wouldn't be, but you know.
Right. No, it was actually really well built. So because of that, there were conversations with, so the National Park Service also runs the Pearl Harbor National Memorial. And if you've been there, most people go to the visitor center and then take a boat ride over to sea and go on to the memorial that sits on top of the USS Arizona that is still submerged. And it's a, you know, it's the resting place for a lot of American heroes. What people may or may not notice, and I encourage you to notice it if you go, anybody else, is as you're on that boat ride, as you look up and down to the left and to the right of the memorial, there are these massive concrete structures that look like islands all in a line. And they were built when the United States knew that entry into World War II was probably imminent, and they wanted to move the rest of the U.S. fleet from San Diego to Hawaii, but there wasn't enough berthing spaces. So they built these massive, essentially concrete islands on these enormous precast concrete piles that were pounded into down into bedrock so that there was a place to dock all the warships. Mm. And they were tied bow and stern to each of the two mooring quays, and then another ship was tied outside of those. So from a landmark, it's the highest level of a landmark that the United States bestows upon a place, which is a National Historic Landmark, an NHL. But as a national park, again, I want to be very clear that there's a lot of great people in the National Park Service we're talking about specifically.
It's okay. I know a lot of ones that aren't great. I've given you phone numbers of people who are great, however. And
right,
I think they're in charge of that, which is awesome.
Well, let me give you an example. So we signed our contracts with the National Park Service and with the Department of Defense over there in 2016. 2021, we still have not started the project.
Oh, dear God.
5 years. Mm. And, you know, and that really kind of came down to, concrete doesn't fall apart. This is too big for so many people to even wrap their heads around.
That's kind of the interesting part to me is that we've all seen concrete deteriorate, but mm-hmm. you don't think about it being able to be kind of rehabbed. You think, well, I guess you got to take it out and do it all over again. But that's obviously not how that works. We're kind of winding into the tail end of this hour. I want you to get started and have to cut you off because I really think this is the interesting part, because all of these monuments,
sure.
we want to keep them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to come back with our guest, Tanya Comas. This is all about veterans, infrastructure, and national parks, kind of how they all intertwine. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Heart and soul.